salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
Hey, everyone.
Today, we're honored to be talking with Dr. Rashid Sumaila. He's a professor and director of ocean and fisheries economics at the University of British Columbia, specializing in bioeconomics, the study of fisheries and living resources, using economic modeling to help people avoid collapse of global fisheries and resulting crises, including migration pulses, piracy, and political instability. Born in Nigeria, Rashid's worked throughout the world, including Norway, Namibia, Hong Kong, and of course, Canada, influencing everyone from the World Trade Organization and the UN to local fishing communities in the Global South. Among his many honors, we presented him our Peter Benchley Ocean Award for Science in 2017. And this past year, he and his UBC colleague, Daniel Pauly, won the prestigious Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement. But before we go into your work, linking fisheries, subsidies, climate change, economics, Rashid, let's talk about your own earliest connections with the ocean. Would that go back to Nigeria's popular beaches or what?
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. I'm an interior person. I'm from the middle of the country. So the my closest to the ocean was the river, a river close by. So the way I got connected to the ocean was when I went to Norway to do my grad studies. So I did my master's and PhD in Norway after my first degree from Nigeria. And, you know, in Norway, you can't get away from the ocean or fish. I mean, they're everywhere. So I got onto a project, and my supervisor was working on fisheries. He said, come join me, and I tell you, you will never regret it, he said, because we really don't, it's not global fisheries economics. It's very narrow. It's a Western thing. It's mainly white males. And he says, you will do very well if you get in here. And he was right. I've never looked back since then.
And you really follow your passion, which is, I guess, a fairly unique passion of economics and applying economics to global fisheries. When did you first publish and begin your approach to fisheries this way?
Yeah, very good. Thank you again for the question. This the passion part of it takes me back to my family. And it goes back to our grandfather, actually. And we will be playing football, soccer, let me say, and jumping around and hitting the walls and the ground. And our grandpa will just say, hey, guys, just because you can hit around doesn't mean you should do it. He said, you should walk on earth as if it feels pain, you know. And this later, I mean, I didn't understand the deepness of this. But with time, I got to realize that this is really sophisticated environmental thinking and also social thinking, because I think anyone who can walk on the ground as if it feels pain will know how to deal with the environment, how to live in harmony, how to deal with fellow human beings, right? Because if you care about the ground, you got to care about living things, right? And I think that is where this passion came from. And then I build it up, and economics comes in because, you know, economics is important. Nature is important. We want a good standard of living for people. Nobody can argue about that. But at the same time, we don't want to destroy our environment by achieving that. And the way to really do this is to bring the two together, think economically and environmentally. And I think that is where this all action ends up in, at the intersection of economics and the environment.
I've also heard you say regarding your grandparents that anything that can live as long as grandma and grandpa should be left alone. So Tell us more about that within the context of your family.
This is beautiful, isn't it? I mean, the whole thing is some of the animals live very long. Fish, for example, the Greenland shark, 400 years, right? And people are discovering plants and animals in the ocean that live long, 100 years and so on. So the whole idea is, hey, guys, you know, everything on earth is not just there for us to eat up, right? And one thing you can actually try, you should do your best to do, is anything that can live as long as your grandpa and your grandfather, as even longer, just leave them alone. They are special, right? This was the point. And I thought that was really a very good guiding principle for me. Yeah.
And I think as you began your work, it demonstrated, you talk about 260 million humans dependent on fishing. Most of them are not responsible for overfishing. I mean, that's mostly industrial fishing for Western markets, for the supermarkets and white linen cloth restaurants in the West. Maybe you could talk about the difference between local fishing and global fisheries.
Wonderful. Yeah, you know, you can split the global fisheries into either two buckets or even more. One is the large industrial commercial big boats that can go off on the sea. They can go far, stay months on the ocean, catch anything they find, and then ship them off to rich countries. This includes China, for example, right? And they just grab the fish from the mouths of these people who are actually coastal people, indigenous people who have lived on their coast and lived on this animal protein for all their history, being taken away by powerful, rich nations. So that is a big dichotomy that we need to have in mind. And these countries do have the money to subsidize their boats so they can go far to West Africa, to Southeast Asia, to go take the fish. So yeah, it is economics, it is nature, it is also ethics and morals, right? And these 260 million people earn some income from fishing. And this is powerful, you know. The ocean is one place where we all meet. And I like to also say that fish don't need visa to go anywhere. They go where they go, right? We've identified one bluefin tuna species that crosses the waters of 54 countries plus the high seas in their lifetime. So this is a global thing, right? And so we need to think that way.
And it's both food security and national security, in the sense that you look at the Somali pirates. They were Somali fishermen who then lost their fishing to industrial trawlers that came and took their fish. First, they hijacked the trawlers. Then they discovered that hijacking's more lucrative than fishing. But, you know, these are the real threats. And I guess a lot of what you do is show that the economically sensible thing to do is not to encourage these far-distance fishing fleets to deplete coastal waters in West Africa and all.
Absolutely. And in our own interest, those of us lucky to be in the rich parts of the world. You know, the Somali story is a big one. And people have written about this. I've contributed a few articles on that. And one of the stories, at least, is that, you know, Somalia just collapsed. There's no real government. You have pockets of gangs that are ruling the place. But then that makes their waters free for all. And then there's a lot of illegal fishing taking place by foreign boats, even dumping of chemicals into their waters. So locals vigilantes decided, we have to protect our waters. And they started initially doing reasonable work. But you know what happens without regulation, without any serious government, that turned into this criminal activity of piracy. And the whole world paid dearly for this, right? I mean, there was a time, I think, the U.S. had vessels there, I mean, trying to make sure vessels with goods can pass through, right? Very expensive. Yes, so little things can start here and end up being a global problem. Let's do our best to stop them.
So if the World Trade Organization says stop the subsidies, the trade pressures for other goods and services will hopefully force countries like Spain or China or Taiwan to stop funding overfishing.
Exactly. And there is an agreement that says you cannot subsidize illegal fishing, number one. You cannot subsidize the fishing of any stock that is already declared to be overfished. And you cannot subsidize boats that fish where there's no management. That is the high seas, essentially. And so that's the first agreement, and we're asking for more.
After 20 years of work, like with the WTO, the UN has now passed this high seas agreement that can be a treaty that can not only prevent commercial fishing on the high seas, but create a reserve against other extractive industries like deep sea mining, potentially. Yep. You've done the economics on a full range of ocean activities, and what do you see as most threatening?
Yeah, so ocean activity is the most threatening. I think, number one, you have the bottom trawlers, right? Because of their impact on the seafloor and the habitats there. So that is one. Then this recent push for deep sea mining, it really wakes me awake. It keeps me awake in the night. Because can you imagine, even on land, we see most of what they do, the damage to the environment. Can you imagine 8,000 feet down there with all this gear to go in and catch and take minerals that, according to engineers I've talked with, we don't need really, even to make the energy changes we want to make. We have enough to do that, where we know how to mine on land. So that is another big one that is worrisome, really. And of course, you have the illegal fishing, which also is being on the high seas and fed out away.
Now, can you name the Big Eight? You just mentioned the Big Eight, which is the eight countries that are most overfishing the world's waters.
The world's waters and the high seas in particular. We are talking about China. China is big. It's always there. You have Korea. You have Taiwan. You have Spain. So these are the four that just come to my mind right away. Yeah. And they take up to 70% of all the benefits from the high seas, which is not fair. It's not ethical, because we all agree, I think it's in the laws and the rules, that part of the ocean is the heritage of humankind, I have to say, right?
So
I always make sure we're all on. This is our world, all of us. So, awesome. Yes. Yeah.
In your book, Infinity Fish, you developed a holistic valuation of fish where you want everybody to take into consideration the value of fish as food, but also as a source of jobs, a way for communities to demand better resource management, putting a dollar value on things like health, the environment, communities, and governments. And you say that this would really impact how people make choices to actually take care of our fish and resources. So elaborate on that for us. It's such a great idea.
The concept of infinity fish. And it came up when I was giving a talk. I was asked to give a talk in Namibia. And in that country, two natural resources are really important: fish and diamonds. Okay. Each of them at least 10% of the gross domestic product. So it's so important. And they always at each other's throat, because actually the mining takes on offshore, so they and the fishes. So I go up there and I tell them, I really think fish is more valuable than diamond. And this is crazy to say in Namibia, everybody thinks diamond is. And my justification are this. Number one, fish is renewal, right? And if you manage it well, it can continue to give you benefit forever, to infinity, right? Even if the benefit is small year in, year out, you sum it to infinity mathematically, you get infinity fish and infinity benefit. So that is the main source of that. But diamond is not. And I say, and I know people tell you diamond is forever, but diamond is not forever. If you have a diamond deposit, you take a ton of it today, you can never take that ton again. And I know you will tell me, and there were three ministers in the audience. I say, I know you tell me, we will invest that money from diamond and it will give us benefit. And I say, but I know, all three of you, your governments are running deficits. You never save any penny. So I rather have my fees for sure, right? So, and the second reason, big reason, is that fish is really valuable to many. And I ask a question, how many of you have seen raw cut diamond in your lifetime? Anytime I do that, maybe a person or two, right? Then I say, how many of you have eaten fish this week? And the whole room, yeah, you know. So that's another reason, right? I mean, so, and the whole thing is, my goal for doing this is to say we need to check how we value things. The way you value something, the valuation, what you value is what you take care of. And we actually did a paper. Me, I spent a summer with a colleague, Alex Rogers, in Oxford. And what we did, one of the things we did was to study the carbon sequestration value of fish in the high seas versus the value of the fish we catch from the high seas, right, and sell. And I tell you, we found out in a year, the contribution, the sequestration contribution is 10 times the value of the fish we catch and sell and eat. So 10 to 1, that is what we did, we showed in that paper. And more similar papers are appearing all over showing that. It's quite a big job because without that sequestration, we will either have to cut our CO2 to balance what they take down, which means some economic activities cannot take place, which has a cost, or we will have to pay to clean up ourselves. So that is a big service. That's real money savings for humanity that these animals are offering to us.
And I just want to reemphasize that because that's such an amazing figure you've come up with, which is the fish, the large fish and the whales absorbing all that carbon sequestered in plankton and pooping it or dying and taking it down to the bottom as whale fall. That's actually, the value of that is greater than just eating them and throwing away the bones.
Yep, that is exactly what we found. Yeah.
For the you're saying that like stopping overfishing, saving whales, it's really climate action.
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you feel about marine protected areas, since we're talking about climate action, reducing fisheries? How does that play a role into this whole concept of infinity fish and protecting our planet?
And also the, because great minds think alike, also the commitment of the Biden administration and the UN to 30 by 30, protecting 30% of the land and water. So yeah, tell us the role of marine
protection. And I'm going to take an economic look at this because we have ecological arguments, great ones. But even if you're thinking purely economically, MPAs should be part of our management tools. It has to be applied. Why? Because there's uncertainty in what we do. We don't know everything. We make errors. So it's kind of an insurance. You know, you're buying insurance to protect yourself from all the things that can happen that you don't know about. And no matter how much you try, right? So that's an economic argument. So I have argued that the insurance value of marine protected areas alone justifies their existence, you know, and we've made some calculations about that. So that is a crucial part of it. And 30% didn't just come out of there was a study which I wasn't part of that looked at all the literature around marine protected areas and came up with the 30% minimum that we need to protect in order to have this insurance value and all the other ecological values. Therefore, 30 by 30 is a good move by the world, in my view, and the High Seas Treaty actually pushes that also. So if we can protect at least 30%, that really takes us to another level in terms of protecting the ocean and life in the ocean, and therefore taking us closer to infinity fish.
Let's talk about plastic pollution. Oh. And, you know, there's more and more awareness. We know that it's a fossil fuel. We're talking about heat and the environment. And it seems like the culprit really is the burning of carbon and then what we do with that, plastics, etc. So what brilliant ideas do you have for us to tackle this one?
Yeah, plastic pollution is a huge problem, right? I mean, and the thing is we have to, actually I was involved in the National Academy of Sciences study on this, where the title is U.S. Contribution to Plastic Pollution in the Ocean. And we identify six different stages of this plastic business that we need to intervene. Number one, we just have to reduce consumption of plastic to the barest minimum, to the most essential.
Just stop your use. Yes.
That's it. That's it.
Go back to our grandparents. You refer to your grandparents frequently, and I agree. Back to glass and aluminum and recyclable materials.
Let's go backward on this one. You know, there was a movie about plastic, which was screened in downtown Vancouver. They had a panel and I was one of them. Uh-huh. And this is going to be fun. I don't know whether you want to put this on the show, but you decide. So I go up there, they showed this was the week that one president called Africa shithole, right? Shithole country.
I kind of remember that one.
Yes, name names. That was Trump.
This was just for us, you know. So when we finished and I was commenting, I said, you know, when I was growing up in Africa, a lot of our food is actually wrapped in banana leaves, in corn leaves and so on. It was really, and it's delicious when you eat, you know, whether it's kinky or is whatever, you wrap it up. And then we were told that this is primitive or something. You get the picture. Everybody just converts to plastic. Maybe we have to look back at this these crazy places and learn something. So you made me remember this, Vicky. And I tell you, when I said that, I got their permission. I said, can I say this? They said, go ahead, Rashid. So when I said that, they line up. You know, it's a movie. They're just checking me for saying that. They love this so much.
How does all your career of studying the fisheries get altered by these radical climate shifts we're seeing?
Radical climate shifts. It's very scary, actually. On the 24th of January, we're still in February, right? I was invited, actually, to come and testify at the Senate by the Senate Budget Committee, Senator Whitehouse. And that was a topic, climate, ocean, and economics, fisheries economy or ocean, blue economy, right? And this was the topic. It was really, there were five of us on the panel, from an ecologist right through to a fisher. And all five of us really talked about how serious climate change is changing so much in the ocean, and therefore the blue economy. And I talked about the four deadly, how do we call it? The four deadly things, the deadly four. I think that was how I is. The people talk about the deadly three. I added one more. And we're talking about the sea surface temperature increasing, ocean acidification, deoxygenation, and sea level rise. And each one of these, they compound these problems you are talking about. Coral reefs supply, they don't cover much of the ocean, but they provide, I think if I remember, at least 30% of all the fish catch. Very important part, habitat there. And like you said, they are just dying like crazy. So what to do? We really have to get serious about mitigation. And I know many people are talking a lot about adaptation, which is important because it's already happening. But to really deal with this, we have to take mitigation seriously. Because my fear is, as we keep piling on the CO2, our mitigation office will be just running short of what is needed. Again and again and again, right? You put a seawall and then it's like this and it's like that. Where are you going to end? So we got to get to the root cause. But this is changing massively a lot. And a lot of the fish are moving from the equator areas towards the poles. That's the sea, the animals like all of us, right? If you have your range of temperature, so they move. Those that cannot perish. And the thing is, they move to the poles, and the Arctic is known as a hotspot for ocean acidification. So here is fish running away from boiling water into acidic water. Just think about that. I mean, it's not a good picture at all. And that's why we should keep doing what we are doing even harder to get the message out.
It's a political conflict. I mean, you know, the old analogy of boiling a frog, you don't tell the frog to adapt, you turn off the flame.
You just turn off the flame. You just turn off the flame. I love that.
So you're having a lot of good influence and you're traveling a heck of a lot. How often do you actually get to go to the ocean or get some free time around or in the ocean?
I actually try to do this as often as I can. When I get to a country, I go there. Last June or so, I was in Malaysia. I was at the coast. I talked with fishers. I talked with market. There was one lady, and I cannot forget this. I tell you, she was there at the beach selling fish, trying to sell fish. I took my camera to snap her, and And when I saw the fish on the table, I tell you, I couldn't snap a single photo. It was so pathetic. They were few and they were small. And this woman is standing there. That's probably where she's getting or hopes to get her income to feed the family. It was so pathetic. And then I look out the plastic all being blown offshore. And the fishers are sitting fixing their net because there's just no fish to catch. So I tried to go really to look around and learn more and see what is actually going. Get on the boat and go out. And in Senegal, we went after a big trawler. The end of the line movie, they flew me to Dakar. And we went on, and this trawler was shrimping, was looking for shrimp. And they will catch nice fish and throw them out because they're high grading. They want only the very valuable, expensive shrimp in their boat. So they were throwing them off and we're following them with our small vessel, picking up this fish. We came back and the coastal village, we had a nice barbecue with the villagers with fish. They were just dumping in the ocean.
I catch barbecue.
Oh my God. Yeah. And the villagers, this is good food, right? But they were wasting. Polluting the ocean. I mean, this is one of the things I saw that really touched me.
Dr. Rashid Somalia, you've been such an inspiration, and we love your work and how you can really impact the world and our thinking and the way we do things. So thank you so much for being on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's amazing. I really believe in getting the message to the people who can use it. And that's what you believe too with your podcast. So all the best and thanks a lot.
Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helberg and myself, Vicki Nichols Goldstein, with support from Natasha Benjamin and Ellie Curla. Rising Tide's editing services and technical support is provided by Studio Cape May. The theme song is written and performed by Ethan Kenbarg. You can find Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast at bluefront.org or download it from Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.